Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Andy, Don, and Dude.
See, episode's so nice, we're going to do it twice. It's the Album Nerds Podcast. Dude, I got Andy and Don with me. Andy, what the hell's going on? Ready to double up?
I don't know, man. I got a strong sense of deja vu going on here. What's going on?
That's just a glitch in the matrix, my friend.
Yes.
Whoa. No, this is just our double album. This is our white album.
Yeah.
We should not give it a title. It's just the Album Nerds.
It's just Album Nerds.
Yeah. This is the Album Nerds Podcast, and we love albums, the album format, talking about songs, artists, etc. And we really love double albums, apparently. So this is our second week now where we're going to cover double albums. There was just so much to choose from that we had to do it twice. We've got a great show. We'll get those three album picks discussed. Don is going to ask us a deep question. We're going to do some shout outs to some album related items that we're digging. And then we're going to spin that wheel of musical discovery to find out what we'll talk about next time. This week, we're going to do it again.
Double up. That's what I'm talking about.
Well, as we discussed last week, you know, sometimes the traditional LP length of 44 minutes was not enough for some artists. So we had the double album, and Andy brought us Miles Davis, Bitches Brew from 1970. I introduced us Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me, the double album from The Cure from 1987. And we did the Beatles' self-titled album known as The White Album from 1968. This week, we dig further and discuss three more double albums. It's episode 2 of our double podcast.
So this is like flip the record over kind of thing?
Yep.
Okay.
So double albums are still made in this era. It's kind of harder to define what that length would be because albums can just be so long, either on CD or in the streaming sphere. Mm-hmm. There's really no time constraints, you know? I don't know what that line is anymore, but I dug into things a little further back in the past. How'd you guys do?
Yeah, I mostly went back into the past, too, to more of that traditional double album era. One thing I hadn't really listened to too closely was Led Zeppelin's Physical Graffiti. Dug into that a fair amount from the mid-70s. Really enjoyed it. Man, they're such... I mean, obviously, they're such a great band. But yeah, a lot of good songs on there.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
It's not hit-filled, but it's... I think that's good. It definitely feels more exploratory.
Feels more like an album.
Yeah.
So enjoyed that. I've been a Swans fan for maybe the last 20 years, but I didn't hear, I think it's their debut record, Children of God, 1987. Very cool. Still sounds like Swans, even back in the 80s somehow. They were really pioneers of that heavy sound. And then maybe my favorite Nine Inch Nails record from 1999, the Fragile double record. Really,
Fragile, I think.
Fragile, yes.
Fragile. It must be Italian. Yeah.
No, that's a really underrated record, I think. It fits the format really beautifully, and there's some really interesting production choices on there that I still found pretty interesting even after over 20 years now. How about you, Don?
Well, you know, I mean, actually, double albums have sort of been in the, I think, the public consciousness the past few weeks because, Taylor Swift released a double album to everyone's surprise. It's called the Tortured Poets Department, and I felt compelled to check it out. And it's pretty good. Actually, it's kind of interesting. The second album or the second disc is kind of more of like a folky treatment. Mm-hmm. which I think is pretty interesting.
I think that was like released as like a surprise record, right?
Yeah,
it was like a surprise double album. But that was kind of a cool way to do it.
Does it sound like she's tortured?
I would say so.
Okay.
Not in the way like Metallica might depict someone being tortured,
right? But
in a more poetic way, perhaps.
And then I just wanted to mention another album from the progressive era, you know, which definitely has a lot of double albums. Genesis, what's the plural of
Genesis?
Genocide.
The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway from 1974.
Nice.
It can be a challenge to get through, but there's some interesting things going on that record.
Someday I'm going to really appreciate that record. I've tried so many times. It's hard.
All right, so for me, I went back to Bruce Springsteen, The River from 1980.
That's a good one.
Yeah, so, I mean, it has songs like Independence Day, The Ties That Bind, Hungry Heart, so it's a good listen. Prince, back to Prince, Sign of the Times, 1987. We discussed that in the past on an episode, but I just love the record. The only real hit on it, I guess, or Sign of the Times, the title track, as well as You Got the Look, but quirky songs like Starfish and Coffee, there's just... He just really just plays around with everything here. And it's just such a great listen. And then also the Chili Peppers 2006 double album Stadium Arcadium. I got it the day it came out. I've gone back to it and it's better than I remember. I think I felt like it was too much at the time. It still is. But feature songs like Danny California, Snow, or Heyo, Hump de Bump, which was one of the derailments for me. Desecration Smile was a good track. But there's a lot of good songs on it, but I just felt like maybe they didn't need that many. I'm sure there are fans that would disagree.
It's often is the case.
Okay, so let's get going with that double dose of double albums.
You choose me?
Some of them say your record is sexist and possibly racist. What do you say about that?
The next one's going to be more racist and more sexist, and it's going to be a whole bunch better.
You gotta love Mick Jagger, man. He just does not give a fuck.
Still doesn't. I assume that was recorded years ago, but I've seen recent interviews, and he's the same.
Yeah, he is. He is. That was indeed Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones. We're going to be talking about their 1972 album, Exile on Main Street. This is the 10th studio album for the English rock five-piece. A couple interesting tidbits about the recording process for this record. It was recorded in a villa in southern France.
Yep.
The Stones had been forced to leave the UK because of some unpaid taxes. Had you guys heard about this?
Yeah.
Well, it was pretty common in those days because the tax rate was like ridiculously high in the United Kingdom. So
93% is what I had heard for people in their tax bracket. That's crazy. So the guys were kind of exiled from England and were spending times in France. And that kind of led to kind of a fractured recording environment, I'll call it. Some heavy drug use went into the process here, as well as just lots of kind of friends and hangers-byers stopping by to hang out with this very popular group. But let's jump into the music here. Let's play the lead single. This is called Tumbling Dice.
Sounds like just another way of saying rolling stones or rolling bones, right? I mean, tumbling dice, right?
Yeah, no, it ties in there pretty nicely. I think it's about like an unfaithful gambler, but Mick does a really great job of kind of transposing his unluck with gambling and his lack of luck with women as well. Or this is really, yeah. I was impressed by his lyrics on this album in particular.
I saw in a documentary I was watching, Mick Jagger said that he didn't know anything about gambling or rolling dice. Yeah. And there was like a cleaning lady at the villa that was a gambler, and he had her help with the imagery.
Right. Could get some stories from her.
And then he nailed her. Just kidding. Sorry.
It's certainly possible.
All right, my clickbait headline for this record is Stones transform tax evasion, disorganization, and heavy drug use into a creative landmark. This is one of those cases where I think where artists are just at their creative peak, you know, and they're just have so many great ideas channeling through them. It doesn't matter how much chaos is happening around them or...
Right.
They're putting out gold, and they were kind of going through this kind of creative renaissance here with this handful of records and this era of their career, and it feels like kind of the compilation of that to me, at least. There's a lot of really cool ideas here, as scattered as they may be, but they're all, I think, pretty great.
The Cuffs were off in a way creatively. Like, not only were they able to make whatever kind of music they wanted to at this point in their career, also the freedom to, I mean, there's the F word is on the record. Mm-hmm. They say shit on the record. I mean, these are fairly new things in 1972, especially from a marquee band. Yeah, we're not talking some punk underground thing yet.
Yeah.
So I think just freedom, right?
Yeah.
So
they'd kind of proven themselves. I read a quote from Keith Richards. He said something along the lines of, they no longer had to do what we were told to do. And this was kind of the result of that.
There you go.
All right, let me play another cut from the record here. This is towards the end of it. It's a more of a soulful gospel tinge of this track. It's called I Just Want to See His Face.
Sounds like it's recorded in our basement. Yeah. A church basement.
Yeah, that is kind of... I mean, I feel like the... You know, the whole album kind of has that vibe, like where it's just a bunch of people playing music and just got a tape recorder going. And it just has a very uncontrived or organic feel to that. So that song is credited to Jagger and Richards. According to Jagger, it was a jam with Charlie Watts and Mick Taylor. He said, I think it was a trio originally, though other people might have been added eventually. It was a complete jam. I just made the song up there and then over the riff that Charlie and Mick were playing. Yeah, actually, lyrically, I find it kind of compelling, you know, like for us doubting Thomases out there. It's like, you know, I don't want to talk about Jesus or talk to Jesus or walk with Jesus. I just want to see his face, you know.
Give me some proof.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's so cool. Jagger's came up with that like on the spot. It's like a pretty deep line just for a jam throwaway vocal. Yeah, it's cool.
So my clickbait headline for this album is Torn and Frayed Stones Shine a Light with Double Dose of Guitar, Blues, and Gospel. Surprisingly, this was actually the first Stones album I ever spent time with. To me, this kind of is the Rolling Stones, but I know that it's not, you know, it has a unique position, I think, in the Stones catalog. But yeah, I appreciate it for its just kind of raw and charming character. Although it is very long. And now that I've spent, you know, several weeks processing double albums, I've kind of figured out that it's important to really pay attention to the sides. You know, so like I kind of stop, you know, after I hear the end of side A, it's like I kind of stop and reflect for a second as if I'm kind of flipping the record. It just, to me, it makes listening to this much music, you know, more palatable, you know, in some way.
Yeah, kind of segmented up there.
I found myself comparing it to the White Album, and I think it's similar in some ways because it is kind of stripped down, but it feels much more collaborative than the White Album.
Yes,
it does.
It's a band album. It's not them all getting their pieces in it. And the overall sound, you're not turning on a dime at every second here. You can sink into it.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me is really standing out as being incredibly excellent is kind of their take on like a country and Americana sound. I think that's particularly evident in the track Sweet Virginia, which just is incredibly soulful and has like, you know, has a bit of a country twang to it, which surprised me the first time I heard it. But both those songs just have a great, just like loose jam quality to them. And I think they really, kind of in the middle of the record, you feel like kind of tent poles holding up the middle, which, you know, could be a little saggy otherwise, but
it's just, this is one of those songs I was talking about where you just sink into it, like the slide guitar and the British southern twang. it works,
man. He totally sells that song. I think Jagger sounds so great there. But they also explore a fair amount of their more, I guess you'd say, classical blues boogie sound. Why don't we play one of those cuts next? This is the opening cut, Rocks Off.
Yeah, so Rocks Off kicks off the album, but it is sleazy, right?
Yeah.
I think that kind of, there is a sleaze throughout the record. A lot of sexual innuendo and
a lot of hedonism, I would say. Just kind of rock and roll excess.
Yeah, I mean, it's sex, drugs, and Rolling Stones for sure throughout the entire thing. The word fuck is used on this song. Plug in, flush out, and fight and fucking feed. I mean, I'm sure there were a lot of delighted teenagers when this album came out, you know?
Yeah, Jagger, don't give it.
I mean, talk about thinking that why don't we do it in the road is dirty? Please. That's child's play. It's cryptically, sexually charged lyrics throughout the album. and throughout the song. Keith Richards explained the album's title, Exile on Main Street, in his autobiography, linking it to their romantic lifestyle, symbolizing their displacement and freedom from all the conventional norms that they had been part of in organized society before they went and had their own country in that villa. My clickbait headline is The Stones Sneer and Strut Their Way Through Exile on an 18-track chaotic rock and roll symphony recorded in a sweltering French villa's basement. I guess it's that heat was part of the problem. They had electrical problems. Stuff was, the equipment was fading in and out. They were fading in and out as performers. Yeah. And vocals drop at times. Things are uneven. It's just so do-it-yourself sounding, which I think, you know, again, for a band at the top of their game and popularity,
yeah,
to make basically a garage album, a double, is pretty amazing. I've always found this album overwhelming, mm-hmm. but when I allowed myself to roll with it, if you will, I really got into it, and I enjoyed every song, every spin, and it was over too quickly most of the time.
Wow. That's saying a lot about a double record. Mm-hmm. There are 18 cuts, I think. Even Mick Jagger says the quality varies a little bit from cut to cut. I don't know. As a whole, though, I think it does hold up exceptionally well after all these years, and obviously pretty influential. I'm going to nominate it for the Album Nerds Hall of Fame. Not a huge Stones fan myself, but I think this record is undeniably important, and I think it deserves to be in the Album Nerds Hall of Fame. What do you guys think?
Yeah, it's amazing how, like, those original British invasion bands, how they're all just so different. And they, like, you know, so the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, the Kinks, and they all have their double albums, and they're all so different from each other. And this, I think you could make a case that this is the best of the group. So, yeah, just awesome album. And it really is, like, to me, this is the Stones, and this is the best of what they deliver, you know, raw energy. And they really, more so than the Beatles, they really wear their influences, you know, on their sleeves. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to say yes. I mean, I think I've said enough to make the case that I think this is a classic, especially if you put it in the category of double albums, it rises even higher. Mm-hmm. So, absolutely.
So congratulations to the group. Welcome to the Album Nerds Hall of Fame. Once again, the album is Exile on Main Street by the Rolling Stones. If you haven't heard it, boy, you are missing out.
I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
If you're enjoying the show, and we hope you are, do us a solid and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Maybe we made you laugh, or you discovered an album you enjoy. Leaving a review keeps the show going and helps other music fans find us.
Ma'am, who is this queen of disco?
Donna Summer. Now how do her name appear in a phone book? Summer Donna.
Keep going.
Summer Donna.
Summer Donna, that's right. Summer Donna.
Summer Donna.
Wow, that's pretty funny.
So my pick for a double album is from the queen of disco, Donna Summer. Her album Bad Girls, which was released in April of 1979. This is her seventh studio album. She was actually born Donna Adrian Gaines in Boston, Massachusetts in 1948. This is another collaboration with Giorgio Moroder and Pete Blott, also with contributions from German composer Harold Faltermeyer, which you might remember did Axel F. And like the Top Gun soundtrack and stuff like that. Anyway, so here's a song from the fourth side of the album, Our Love.
Wonder why Don likes this one.
A little synth pop, anyone?
This was on side D, right? Yeah. D stands for, you know, for Don.
There you go.
So there is some synth pop going on here. In fact, New Order have stated over the years that the rapid fire kick and snare beat of Our Love inspired their similar drum pattern on their hit Blue Monday. You guys know Blue Monday?
Sure.
How does it feel?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So it's an interesting album. You know, the first two sides are kind of what you would expect, you know, these kind of disco hits. Then the third side is really like four kind of ballady tracks. And then this final side is like kind of four sort of synth pop tracks. My clickbait headline for this double album is Summer celebrates the close of disco era and opens the door to electronic dance.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, Donna Summer is not somebody I paid much attention to, but you know, over the years I've heard, you know, rock artists and, you know, anybody involved in like electronic dance cite some of her records. And I think this, you know, this collection is a good showcase of what she did and what makes her notable. 71 minutes of disco pop seems like a lot.
Right.
And I suppose it is, but I got through it and, you know, I thought it was an enjoyable ride.
We all survived.
Well, let's hear some more. This was, one of the big hits. This is Hot Stuff.
So Hot Stuff kind of sounds like, I don't know, it even sounds a little bit like Foreigner or something at the time. I mean, there's definitely a rock beat and vibe to that song that goes beyond disco and gets more into pop rock, which is, I think, what intrigued me about this record.
Yeah, I think that was intentional at the time because disco was kind of on its way out and rock, at least 80s rock sound, was kind of on its way in and trying to catch that wave, right?
The song reached number one on the Billboard Hot 100, becoming the second of four songs by Summer to achieve this feat. Strong R&B and soul feel, great vocal performance, and the rock and disco elements are blended in a way that kind of ushers in the new dance pop sound that comes into the early 80s. She won a Grammy Award, I believe. But my clickbait headline for this one is Donna Summer's Bad Girls, Beyond Disco Diva, unveiling the surprising depths of Summer's versatility and musical evolution. Much more varied than I expected. I guess it depends on your perspective on it, but it was varied to me because it didn't sound like dance floor anthems. There were ballads, there was instrumentation, it sounded organic in many ways. Donna Summer was able to keep her overall sultry vibe, but branch out in these varying styles. And there's themes of empowerment, love, desire, nightlife, and it kind of reflect the energy of the disco era, but also leaving that behind a little bit too. So I dug it. Like the more dancier tracks, like Lucky, it's more inventive and more synthy than a lot of the other disco songs of the time. Mm-hmm. It's funky and atmospheric, you know, and I like the experimentation going on here.
Seems like there's some early sampling going on, like in the title track, Bad Girls, there's like that whistle sound where it like blows, it's like a whistle and then it's toot, toot, beep, beep.
Yeah. What is with the beep beep? Are there like cars passing by?
I think so. Or right, maybe because you're beeping at the Bad Girls.
Right. That's kind of what I thought. Yeah. Well, no, you're right. It's the producers here, Giorgio Mordor and Pete Belante.
Mordor?
I will take the ring to Mordor.
Sort of Lord of the Rings character, right? Pretty influential guys. I recognize the names from just you know, dance music later on in the 90s as being kind of a big influence of what they were doing back in the 70s here. Yeah, I think they're pretty pioneering, you know, front of the pack kind of guys here. She wasn't working with a bunch of schlubs by any means. No.
Certainly not. Well, let's hear another one. Journey to the Center of Your Heart.
That's got that disco drum, man.
Yeah, strong disco vibe there. But I don't know, man. I think that worked really well. They built up beautifully to that track six there on the record. It's got some psychedelic qualities to it. There's also a saxophone in it, which somehow works, I think, in this case. Yeah, my clickbait headline for this album is Summer starts out hot, but cools off quickly halfway through. Initially, I was just not really interested in listening to this record at all. I was just not a huge disco fan, to be honest. I'd heard it before, but I just wasn't a huge fan. But yeah, I think to her credit, or their credit, I think the first half of this record is really interesting. It's beautifully mixed from track to track. I can't think of too many records from this era that were really intentionally mixed from song to song like this, where they're fading out the old beat and bringing the new one. It sounds like almost one song at times. And it really does kind of come to a head there on that sixth track there, Journey to the Center of Your Heart, which I think is groovy. It's got kind of a club feel, but also has like that psychedelic vibe to it, I would say. It feels a little spacey, like we're kind of getting out there a little bit, which I appreciated. I don't know, but I guess once we got to the seaside and the ballads there, I just was kind of fell off for me with that part. We kind of lose the beat completely. And Donna, she has a nice voice, but I wouldn't, say she's an exceptional vocalist. Yeah, the end of the record with the synth pop stuff, I did enjoy a little bit more, but I was kind of checked out by that point, I guess. The first half of this record, the first 30, 40 minutes, I would listen to that anytime. I think it's really good, and that's a long way from where I started, so I was impressed.
Yeah,
that's cool. It does kind of, it does slow down, but I think at least the end track, Sunset People, did some interesting stuff. It's a really good closer, and perhaps not as many songs are required, but it's worth getting to this track at the end. It gives you that vibe of the nightlife, the people that are going out to the clubs and stuff, just really effectively.
Yeah, it does.
So
they did a great job organizing the record. I really appreciated that. I think that part flows, even if I don't love every section of it. I think it still makes sense as an album.
All right. Well, summer is coming, and maybe it's time to check out a little Donna Summer, the Queen of Disco. The album is Bad Girls from April 1979.
Disco's dead. I don't want to live.
Excuse me, I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Now it's time for Deep Questions by Don. So in part one, we talked about, how, sometimes double albums are kind of too much of a good thing. So we talked about some things that were, just too much. Now we're going to do the opposite. What are some things you can't get enough of?
Your love. To start,
The obvious one for me would be music. I don't think I've ever really been sick of the entire genre of music at any point in my life, so
right,
there's always something to listen to, I think, which is great. I'll get sick of movies sometimes, but music, you guys agree?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the answer all of us should give, being that this is a music focused podcast for album obsessed nerds, so
required to say yes. I was trying to think of what foods have I never get sick of. The only thing I could think of was bananas. I eat at least one or two bananas a day, and I have for probably 15-20 years, so I always look forward to my banana.
And they're so cheap, you could have so many bananas.
You could eat 50 bananas a day and not go broke easily.
But it's the elusive sweet spot, that one or two days where the bananas are just the way you like them.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's kind of the art of the banana.
At green, they are disgusting. Right. And as soon as they start to get soft, disgusting.
You just want just a little shade of green, just a little touch of green.
Yep. Yeah.
There you go.
Isn't that a Dead song?
Touch of green. Touch of green. Something. Yeah. How about you, Dave?
Yeah, my wife. I don't get sick of her.
My wife.
She continues to be lots of fun. But music, obviously, was on the list. Kindness, people being kind to one another.
You get sick of people being nice to you?
Just even seeing people be nice to each other, regardless of backgrounds, religion, whatever. I think that's an important part of humanity.
Good answer.
Beans. I eat a lot of beans.
Magical fruit.
Bean burritos. And I'm not a vegetarian. My body is just bean impervious now. I grew up hating them as a kid, but now just lots of rice and beans and chicken and rice and beans. And it's just black beans, pinto beans, navy beans, green beans.
Does your wife have enough of the beans? The beans can hang out for a while.
I think most of the time everything's all right, but there have been reports of sleepless nights for her.
Reports.
Because of me and the beans.
Sorry, I farted.
I sleep through it.
So I agree. I agree, you know, obviously with music and my wife and all that. But, you know, I just can't get enough sugar. And in fact, you know, one of my one type of sugar that, or example of sugar that I can't get enough of, I guess, is like cereal. I mean, I don't eat it that often, but when I do, I mean, I could eat an entire box, like especially like just the real junk cereal. You know, like Captain Crunch or Frosted Flakes or something.
I have cereal every day, but it's Kashi, like dried fruit. But it's sweet.
I like that stuff too. I'll do any cereal.
When you get older, kids, you eat a lot of beans and protein fiber filled cereals.
Enjoy the real sugar while you can.
And of course, I can't get enough of the Album Nerds podcast.
Sure. Of course. Right.
Can you get enough of the Album Nerds podcast? Let us know. Hit us up on Instagram and Facebook, or leave a comment on our website, albumnerds.com.
Send this directly to Don, please.
We don't want to be labeled a political band, because we certainly aren't that. You know, we're in our 20s, and, you know, this is our college. This is where we're discovering our opinions. What do we think of the world, you know? We read a book, and now we know everything, you know?
He doesn't sound 20.
Well, that was a recent interview, but he was speaking about when they were in their 20s. And so that was James Hetfield of Metallica, who was referencing the album And Justice for All from August of 1988. Metallica is a band that we really haven't mentioned too much on the show, except
for
50% of it. They're an American heavy metal band formed in 1981. James Hetfield and Lars Ulrich are the, I guess, the principals, but Kirk Hammett has been in the band for a long, long time, and he deserves a lot of the credit for their guitar work. Known for fast tempos, aggressive musicianship, influential instrumentals, one of the big four of thrash metal, alongside Megadeth, Anthrax, and Slayer. And then, of course, this is the album where Jason Newsted joined the band after their original bassist Cliff Burton died in a bus accident on their tour bus, which crashed, and they were all injured, but he did not survive. So that does play into this record a little bit. So why don't we jump in and listen to a little bit of the opening track, Blackened. All right, so that is an eerie song with an eerie intro. Reversed riffs are used, heavy, fast guitars, intricate musical elements, which is kind of, at this point, their stock in trade. The more intricate, the better. The song's signature is an E Phrygian, giving it a distinctive and ominous sound. The changes in tempo on this song is like over the top for them. But this is what they do. Apparently, it alternates between 4-4, 3-4, 5-4, 6-4, and 7-4 measures interchangeably throughout the song.
Wait, can you clap that out for me?
No, I can't. that's why it's so intense. And Jason Newsted, the band's bassist at the time, contributed to the song by showing James Hetfield the opening riff on bass. So he gets writing credits on that song. None of the rest. My clickbait headline to describe the album, Metallica's And Justice for All exposes the dark underbelly of power, politics, and war, leaving out the traditional demons, monsters, and bass guitars.
Nice.
It's got some progressive metal elements, sad sounding in the composition. They lost their best friend. You know, it's about the downfall of society, hypocrisy, politics, corruption, and the scales of justice, which are tied, broken, and financially corrupt.
I think the whole record itself sounds kind of tinny in comparison to most other metal, even at the time. And maybe that's just the lack of bass, but I think overall it's a very thin mix, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that does factor into the listening experience here.
Yeah, it loses, I guess, without the real low end and those power chords, you know, you lose some of that like thunder sound that you get.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't miss it so much.
But I never noticed when it was popular, when I've listened to it over the years, until it started being a thing on the internet that there was no bass. But the drums are pretty bassy, and the rhythm guitar also drives that sound. So, but yeah, the guitars themselves do sound a little trebly.
Yeah, I'd agree.
All right, so why don't we jump into the big one entitled One?
Darkness imprisoning me. All that I see, absolute horror. I
One of the finest moments in heavy metal ever, if you ask me.
Definitely my favorite moment from the record. I wouldn't say metal at all, but I think it definitely stands out. Yeah, you know, the album deals a lot with injustices of society, you know, imposed on individuals. Seems to be about a war vet who's severely injured and maybe trying to end his own life, but can't communicate because he's so injured. It's pretty intense subject matter, but that song's pretty interesting. Yeah. It shifts quite a few times. The beginning's much more melodic and kind of goes into this machine gun style rhythm about halfway through. It's fun. I'm not going to lie. I enjoy that song every time it comes on.
When in 89, when they performed that on the Grammys, that's the first time I ever saw them like as humans performing. And I wasn't super into metal then, but I remember being impressed and with the intensity of what they were doing.
Yeah.
I didn't give it enough credit at the time. And this is when, you know, my friends and, you know, they were all of a sudden into Metallica and Megadeth and stuff. And I was just not interested in it at all. And then, you know, one of my friends said, no, this song is inspired by Johnny Got His Gun. It's about a guy who loses his arms and legs. And
then all of a sudden you're like, I'm in.
Yeah. but then I remember, you know, a couple of years later when I took like an independent reading class in high school, I'm like, oh, I got to read that book. And so I did. So, you know, Metallica, you know, made me want to read.
Wow.
Wow. No one's ever said that before.
Unexpected consequence. So my clickbait headline for this album is Metallica progresses their sound and lays the foundation for their empire of metal mediocrity. Oof. I think this is a little bit of the beginning of the end for them. I mean, definitely are interesting moments on this record, and I don't mean to discount them. I appreciate the progressive lane they're heading down, but I can see very clearly in the not too distant horizon, the Black Album, and then the subsequent,
which is a great album,
which is a very commercial sounding record in comparison to their earlier albums.
So what?
I think what happened would be like is one kind of blew up for them, and then it kind of opened the door, I guess, for this potential stardom that they embraced.
Or they embraced growing and changing their sound and not making the same record thrash song after thrash song when that genre had started to be phased out. You know, people have to progress musically as well, Andrew.
It's just weird that they would become more progressive and then like throw it all out the window almost immediately after a glimpse of the money showed in the window.
Oh, please. Yeah, right. Okay.
The biggest standout for me on this record, getting back to this album, Kurt Hammett, he's always been the standout member of the band for me. And I think he really shines on this album. He brings a lot of just class and musicality to what sounds like just a, you know, a very blunt instrument that they usually are using to get across their point. So I think he sounds great here. He sounds way better than he did on a couple of previous records. But yeah, otherwise, it's not my least favorite Metallica album by any means, but it's probably not my fave.
Well, we should just shut this whole thing down. But instead, let's listen, since they're selling out, why don't we listen to a little bit of Dire's Eve.
According to Hatfield, that song portrays a child who's been sheltered from the outside world, which is something I guess he could relate to. I guess his, you know, parents were like Christian scientists.
Christian scientists.
They went to the Church of Christian Science or whatever.
Yeah. So I guess, yeah. So they weren't like, they didn't wear like lab coats and stuff, but they. okay. My clickbait headline, is Harvesters of Sorrow Refuse to Go Mainstream, But It Will Find Them. So, you know, I it's interesting now that, you know, this is the album that kind of, you know, got them to the brink of stardom. And of course, you know, the Black Album, you know, really, took them there. But this is not an album that is, you know, I mean, they're not trying to be commercial here. You know, in fact, it's, you know, it's much more progressive than Master of Puppets. I mean, it's a thrash album, but it feels, you know, tighter than some of their previous works, and it's more polished. But yeah, you know, it's, you know, it feels kind of experimental. You know, Dude pointed out the changes in time signatures and stuff. Kind of reminds me of like what Tool does, you know, just constantly changing the tempo. And, I hadn't really, you know, drawn a big connection between those two artists before.
Yeah, it was around the time that Tool sold out. just like Metallica, that they took on the time signature changes.
It's a classic sign of selling out when you start changing the time signatures.
You're right. Yeah. Yes, yes. And you try to make cool compositions, right?
Yeah, it's not a perfect album, but I enjoyed it. I mean, all these, the first four or five, Metallica albums, I can just kind of lose myself in the thrash, and it's just so well executed. But, I did spend some time with the Black album after listening to this, and it's just amazing the sonic differences, the production. Mm-hmm.
You hear everything, for one.
Yeah, that's true.
That helps, yeah.
And they're less meandery. The songs are tighter.
Yeah, this does kind of feel like it marks the end of that thrash era.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it does.
Well, one thing I will say is Harvester of Sorrow is just a super cool turn of phrase. I don't know if they made it up or they got it in a book or something, but that's just an awesome phrase. Love it. Now, this technically is a double album. I mean, it does fit on a CD. It does fit on cassette. I think it was a product of the time. 1988 albums were still being pressed to vinyl, and it wouldn't fit. I think it's less intentionally a double album and more just progressive thrash exploration. So that was Metallica's And Justice for All.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
All right. Well, we did two full episodes listening to double albums. It's probably, time where we can branch out a bit. What are some things that you're digging that we can check out?
Well, I got my new release sack here, guys. Take a look at what's inside.
It used to be a bag. Why is it turned into a sack? That is selling out if I ever heard it.
Sponsored by
Sack City.
SackCity.com. All right, it's a debut record from an English four-piece by the name of English Teacher from Leeds. The album is called This Could Be Texas. I assumed they were from Texas, but I guess the English teacher, maybe they should have thrown me out. Anyways, it's kind of a experimental, kind of like an angular rock sound. It's very experimental, though, as the record progresses. I was really enjoying it quite a bit.
Sounds sort of like 80s post-punk mixed with a little Patti Smith, at least on this song, the vocal chat.
Yeah, it's got that kind of like rambly poetic style, like maybe Patti Smith would appreciate. Yeah, so I'm enjoying that one quite a bit. You got kind of a more dance-centric record here from an artist by the name of Nina Archives. The album is entitled Silence is Loud. This is also her debut. She's a vocalist, she's a DJ, she's a songwriter, she's a producer. She calls her music like New Jungle, which is like a type of dance music. It has elements of jungle music, but it sounds pretty fresh to me.
You turn down that silence?
Silence is loud. Definitely. All right, and the last one up here for me is from a artist that's new to me, by the name of Chewbacca, I believe is how you would say it.
I think it's Chewbacca.
This is his brother.
Oh. This is his brother, Chewbacca. Yeah. Oh man, he is a multi-instrumentalist from London, England. He seems to focus primarily in flutes, a different variety of flutes on his album. There's quite a few guest spots as well. Let's play a little bit of the lead single here. This features Moses Sumney on vocals.
You gotta do that.
Yeah. I think Chewbacca plays in that band, just to be accurate here. But
this might be good to fall asleep to.
Yeah, it's very common. If you like that woodwind sound, it's pretty much throughout the whole record.
Interesting.
A little more interesting than that Andre 3000 record we heard that was flute-based earlier in the year.
Right.
Oh, yeah. What you been digging on, Don?
Well, I've actually been spending a lot of time with a recently released record that I won't talk about this week.
I think we all know what it is.
Pet Shop Boys.
So instead, we're going to talk about Modern English. You probably know the song, I Melt With You. I had spent time with their 1982 record, After the Snow, which is pretty good. But I kind of moved on from them. But they have a record released this year. It's called 1, 2, 3, 4.
I Declare Thumb War. Is that
a follow-up? But yeah, it's a solid record. I'm not sure I love everything about it, but there's just like an intensity to it, and it just, it doesn't feel like they're trying to recapture old magic. You know, it's just like, hey, let's record something. You know, we got songs, and here they are.
Cool. Give it a listen.
Sounds kind of cool.
And, well, David Gilmour from Pink Floyd is coming out with a new record. Going to be released in September called Luck and Strange. There is a song out from it called The Piper's Call, which I assume is a reference to Syd Barrett, but sounds interesting.
Hmm. Now, I thought you were not a fan of his because he sold out after Floyd.
I do. I tend to be Team Waters, but I'll give this a chance.
You're both pretty good.
Yeah, sounds interesting. I'll give it a shot, Ski. All right, so for me, again, playing around in the country music scene with a favorite of mine, Charlie Crockett. He has a new album out called $10 Cowboy. You know, it's really his thing. You know, it's a Charlie Crockett record. Got the slide guitar, the twangy delivery, the kind of throwback sound, and but I just really like him, and he puts out so many records, like at least one a year, sometimes two. So
yeah, no, he's great. Would not consider him a discount cowboy by any means.
Not at all. All right, so something else I've been getting back into is Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet.
Just sliding right back in.
Yeah, that's right, from 1986.
He's also a cowboy, so
that's yes. True.
He rides a steel horse, but yes, you are correct. So I'm staying in the cowboy sphere today. So I've got two copies of this on vinyl and one on CD. Grew up loving this record. I used to have it on cassette. Me and my wife have been watching the Hulu documentary, Thank You, Good Night, the Bon Jovi story. And it goes between their 2022 tour and then back and forth of the history of the band and the making of this album. And I think they're up to something. I think there's going to be some big Bon Jovi news in the future. I don't know what, but it's a great story. I recommend watching it, and then you'll probably want to go listen to their records.
Or kill yourself.
Oh, wow. Not a Bon Jovi fan, huh? I thought that song was like metal. Back
in the day. Yeah, so. Right. It's funny. Respective changes.
Okay, well, what have you been digging? Let us know. Hit us up on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at Album Nerds, and also on our website, albumnerds.com.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about that time on the show when I'm reminded of the great American songwriter Ray Charles, who famously said, "What is a soul? It's like electricity. We don't really know what it is, but it's a force that can light a room." With that in mind, let's bring out my friend and yours, Wadbot, to see what we'll be discovering on next week's show.
Your journey of musical discovery continues. The 1990s was a transitional time for soul as well as R&B music, as the horn-filled sounds of the 80s gave way to hip-hop and pop influences. Next time you will explore albums soulfully created in the 1990s.
Soul and R&B music of the 90s. That's tough, because there was, you know, the beginning of the 90s was heavily influenced by the 80s, and then the end of the 90s really was taking on what the sound was to become in the 2000s. So
yeah, it's kind of like the beginning of neo soul, but not quite.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a transitional period for sure.
Back to the new Jack Swing.
Yeah, we could.
That's certainly in there.
All right. Are there any other double albums that we should talk about? How about the 90s soul and R&B? Let us know. Leave a comment on our website or email us at podcast@albumnerds.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at Album Nerds. And please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so via PayPal at albumnerds.com/support.
Thank you for joining us once again on the Album Nerds podcast. We'll catch you next time with some soul glow.
Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next week.
I'm a cowboy on a steel horse I ride. I'm wanted, wanted, dead or alive.
Don walks these streets with a broken six string on his back. He plays for keeps. See ya.
Bye.